On the Robert Novak Joseph Wilson situation, McIver said, Novak reported earlier this year, quoting anonymous government sources telling him that Wilson's wife was a CIA operative. Now, this is apparently a federal offense to burn the cover of a CIA operative. Wilson now believes that the person who did this was Karl Rove. He's quoted from a speech last month at an August 21st public forum in suburban Seattle as saying, at the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog-marched out of the White House in handcuffs. Did Karl Rove tell that? I wasn't prepared for the question, in the sense that I had not spoken to Rove about it yet, but it was phrased in such an emotionally off-putting way, referring to Rove deliberately burning the cover of a CIA operative, that I confidently interrupted McIver. I haven't heard that. That's just totally ridiculous. McIver followed up by asking if Rove had disclosed Plame's name to Novak, and I again said it was totally ridiculous. It was the stance I would maintain as the scandal blossomed. I saw Rove shortly after the briefing in the Roosevelt Room and spoke with him quietly near the doorway to the hallway separating the Roosevelt Room from my office area. I wanted to make sure I hadn't climbed out on a limb. Rove had known Novak for years and spoke with him from time to time, and of course he was known for playing hardball politics. But surely even he knew that leaking classified national security information would cross a line. I was asked in the briefing today about Joe Wilson's comment that he wanted to see you frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs, I said to Rove. A reporter asked me if you were one of Novak's sources and burned the cover of Wilson's wife. I said it was totally ridiculous. You weren't one of Novak's sources, right? Right. Just wanted to make sure, I said. You're right, Rove said. The second time I checked with Rove was on Saturday, September 27th, 2003. Mike Allen, a tireless, 30-something Washington Post White House correspondent who'd covered the 2000 presidential campaign, was working on a piece about the leak investigation along with veteran Post reporter Dana Priest, who covered intelligence matters for the paper. According to Mike, a senior administration official had told them that two senior White House officials had spoken to at least six reporters about Wilson's wife. Mike did not know the names of the aides alleged to have been involved in the leak, but he and Priest viewed their source as credible and planned to run with the story. I was at Camp David that day, where the president was meeting with President Putin and holding a press availability at which each would make statements and then take a couple of questions from their respective press corps. Rove got in touch with my trusted deputy, Claire Buchan, letting her know he'd received an email inquiry from Mike for the story. The implication of the Post story was clear. The White House had disclosed Plame's identity to discredit or even punish Joe Wilson. The story would put the leak of her identity right at the White House's doorstep. Before, it was just two senior administration officials in a Novak column. But now, the Post was reporting that two senior aides, specifically in the White House, had disclosed her identity to multiple reporters, implying the possibility of a concerted effort by the White House to reveal Plame's role and her involvement in her husband's trip to Niger. Claire spoke with Rove before I returned to the White House and the staff fans. I arrived back at my office sometime after 1 p.m., and a short time later got the rundown from her. She informed me that Rove had volunteered to her that Novak had called him about Plame. He hadn't confirmed Plame's CIA status because he didn't know about it. I replied in some bewilderment, Carl spoke to Novak? Claire said he had. I was taken aback that Rove hadn't mentioned the contact to me the first time we talked. Claire and I discussed how that fit with what I had previously said in the briefing on September 16th. It was consistent with what Carl was saying to Claire now. He had not been one of Novak's sources because he could not confirm what he did not know. I felt that Rove should have disclosed this conversation to me previously, so I decided to call him. He repeated to me what he had told Claire earlier in the day. He, Novak, said he'd heard that Wilson's wife worked at the CIA. I told him I couldn't confirm it because I didn't know. Then, knowing where the storyline was headed with the coming Post article, I asked Carl an unambiguous, unqualified, catch-all question. Were you involved in this in any way? I was clearly referring to the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity, information that was believed to be classified, to any reporter. Carl replied categorically, No, look, I didn't even know about his wife. There was no mention of a phone conversation Carl had on July 11th, 2003, with Time Magazine's newest White House correspondent, Matt Cooper, which would remain under double super secret anonymity, Cooper's wit, not mine, for nearly 2 more years. That is when it would be revealed publicly, and to me, that Rove had disclosed Plame's identity to Cooper during that call. Rove's categorical no gave me the assurance I needed to defend a fellow member of the Bush team and fellow Texan I'd known for more than a decade, who was invariably a prime target for our most partisan critics. By Monday morning, September 29th, Joe Wilson, appearing on ABC's Good Morning America, was backing away from his previous assertion that Rove had been responsible for leaking his wife's identity. However, Wilson also asserted during the interview that he believed Rove, at a minimum, condoned the leak. I checked with Rove that day to confirm that he'd neither leaked nor condoned leaking Plame's identity. He assured me that was correct. That day would be the last time I would talk to or hear from Carl about anything specifically related to the leak. As I walked into the Oval Office on the morning of September 29th, it could have been any other day at the White House. As I frequently did, I touched base with the President in the morning before facing the press corps that day. It was an opportunity to get his thoughts on how to respond to a particular issue, to make sure I was keeping him fully abreast of what was on reporters' minds, or just to confirm that my own thinking on how to handle a topic was in line with his own. The Oval, shortly after 7 a.m. and just before the daily senior staff meeting at 7:30 a.m., was a good opportunity to catch him. Other times it would be after his daily intelligence and FBI briefings, or when he was leaving the Oval to head down to the Situation Room for a secure conference call or a meeting of his National Security Council. But today was not like any other day at the White House. The dark cloud of scandal was casting its shadow over us this late September morning. "Good morning, Mr. President," I said as I walked into the Oval, past the couches, across the blue presidential seal in the center of the light beige carpet. His desk was located in front of 3 tall windows, hung with long, golden drapes that could stop bullets, but not the cheery sunlight that filled the office. The elegant desk was made from timbers of the HMS Resolute, the British Arctic exploration ship once recovered by an American whaler. The desk had been used by nearly every commander-in-chief since the British, in a gesture of appreciation, donated it to President Rutherford B. Hayes. Andy Card, the White House Chief of Staff, stood to the left of the President. "Hey, Scott," the President said good-naturedly. "What's on the press's mind today?" "The reports of a Justice Department investigation into the leak of Valerie Plame's name," I said, knowing his question was just pro forma since he, like all of us, was well aware of the topic du jour. "I want to talk to you about it before I gaggle." "Carl didn't do it," the President reflexively said, referring to his senior advisor and chief political strategist, Karl Rove. The "it" clearly meant disclosing Plame's identity to reporters. He was holding on to the armrest and leaning back in his chair behind his desk. He seemed to be in fairly good spirits. "I know," I began, not realizing the President had more to say. "He told me he didn't do it," the President continued, cutting me off mid-sentence. It was just 2 months since Bob Novak had written his article outing Plame and quoting 2 senior administration officials as his sources for the leak. Rove had already denied to me that he'd leaked Plame's name, and now I was learning that he had also told the President that he was not involved. Then the President glanced toward Andy, who had raised his hands above his waist and was now gesturing down with both to indicate to the President that he should keep quiet and stop talking about what was fast becoming a sensitive subject. "What?" the President said, looking at Andy with a slight hint of irritation in his voice. "That's what Carl told me." "I know," Andy said, "but you shouldn't be talking about it with anyone, not even me." Andy was ever cautious. That morning, the Washington Post was reporting that the Justice Department had opened a criminal investigation into the disclosure of Plame's identity. Andy felt his first responsibility as Chief of Staff was to protect the President, his time, his reputation, and his legacy. He had served in 2 previous administrations and knew how scandals can take on a life of their own in Washington. In Andy's view, looking out for the President sometimes meant standing between him and other senior aides, including the chief spokesman. But the President and I had our own unique relationship, shaped in our home state of Texas. And in this instance, he paid little attention to Andy's not-so-subtle effort to keep him from talking to me about what Carl had said. His face showed a bit more irritation as he grimaced with a fine-whatever expression and looked straight ahead away from Andy and me. It was an expression the president showed from time to time when someone on the staff tried to tell him what he should or should not be doing. "I talked to Carl, too," I continued, as I looked back to the president. "He said the same thing to me." "Does the press think he did it?" the president asked. "I've already told them he didn't," I responded, "but I'm sure they will ask again today." I mentioned the Sunday story in the Washington Post, which said that two top White House officials had called at least six Washington journalists to disclose Plame's name and current position at the CIA. I didn't delve further into the president's conversation with Carl, in part because of Andy's unease, but I assumed from his comments that he had asked Carl earlier that morning whether or not he was one of the two sources. It seemed to be fresh on his mind, and I felt confident about defending Carl, since the president, too, had received assurances from him. My impression was that Andy was fully aware of what Carl had told the president. Then I looked at Andy and asked, "Do we know anything more about an investigation?" Andy replied that he had not heard anything new, and as far as he knew, we had yet to hear anything from the Justice Department. The discussion in the Oval that morning, the day we would learn that an investigation was indeed underway, was a moment Andy would later recollect for prosecutors and that I would be asked to confirm under oath before a federal grand jury. I then turned the conversation to the approach I was planning to take with the White House press corps later in the morning at the Gaggle and in the afternoon briefing. The primary White House response to the looming press feeding frenzy would come from me. The president had two public events scheduled at the White House that day, but he was not planning on taking questions from reporters at either one. No one on the staff saw anything to gain from him having to do so, since they would likely focus solely on the leak investigation.